Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the assassination attempt on Venezuela's President Maduro, who was addressing a military audience at the 81st anniversary of the National Army when two drones carrying explosives detonated nearby, injuring seven soldiers. An expert on Venezuela, David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America, who has studied Venezuela for almost 30 years and has lived there for over a decade, and curates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, joins us. We will discuss Maduro's vow of, quote, justice, maximum punishment, and there will be no forgiveness, after blaming the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, for the assassination attempt, along with the usual suspect, the United States. With a little-known group, Soldiers in T-Shirts, taking credit on social media for the drone attack, we will look into Maduro's charges, for which he offered no evidence, and the claim by Soldiers in T-Shirts that they were behind the attack, which was not backed up by any evidence. Then we'll get an assessment of if and when journalists will be either assaulted, injured, or even killed by Trump supporters riled up by the president's incendiary rhetoric, since he regularly calls the press fake, disgusting, and the enemy of the people. And given that many of the people at Trump's rallies belong to far-right fringe groups like QAnon, whose impressionable members believe in the most bizarre conspiracy theories and are heavily armed, we will speak with Peter Stern, a senior reporter at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He runs the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, a website that tracks arrests of journalists, equipment seizures, and subpoenas of news organizations in the United States. And we will discuss the repeated refusal of the White House press spokesperson to stop characterizing the press as the enemy of the people, in contrast to Ivanka Trump, who said they were not, and what journalists can do to protect themselves from vigilantes fired up by Trump's hateful rhetoric against the press. Then finally, we'll examine the bailout of 666 Fifth Avenue, a building that threatened to bankrupt the Kushner family real estate business, which the Guttery-owned company Brookfield Asset Management just paid $1.1 billion in upfront rent for, rescuing Jared Kushner from his vanity purchase, on which a $1.4 billion mortgage payment is due in February of next year. Best-selling author William Cohan, who is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly column in the New York Times, joins us to discuss the extent to which Jared Kushner's White House role has enabled him to get out from under bad business investments. And joining us now from Bogota, Colombia, is David Smaldi, the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for almost 30 years and has written or edited three books on it. And he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights and has testified in the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has written opinion articles for The Washington Post and The New York Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smaldi.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for joining us. And are you allowed into – you're in Bogota, Colombia, next door. Are you allowed into Venezuela? Because I know basically Maduro has basically cut the country off from foreign press. There's very few credentials allowed. And the domestic press, of course, has been entirely taken over by Maduro.
Yeah, well, I won't really know. I'm actually in Colombia right now and headed back to the U.S., so I'm not sure. I know visas are hard to come by these days, but I won't get to know that for some time.
But it is true, is it not, that there's very few foreign reporters allowed into the country now?
Actually, you know, there's Foreign Press Corps, the wire services all have a press corps. Basically, U.S., passport holders that have a hard time getting into Venezuela. So press companies like Reuters has no problem because most of the reporters are British or from elsewhere. And so most of them get in sooner or later, but some of them have difficulty, especially if they have U.S. passports.
So let's talk about this assassination attempt on Maduro using two drones packed with explosives that seem to have gotten reasonably close to him. And they blew up and injured seven soldiers. the bodyguards surrounding President Maduro were able to protect him with the ballistic shields. But what do you know about the incident itself in terms of you know, how close it came to him? Go ahead.
It's not actually all that clear because, you know, the government's version is that there were two drones with explosives that came close to the president and exploded. But there's other versions saying that there were no drones involved, that it was actually an apartment fire and a propane tank that exploded. Nevertheless, there's some other military officers saying that they organized the attack. So it's not at all clear. What is clear is that the government filmed everything, every official act that it does, so it's from many different angles. So if it was a drone attack, there should be video evidence of it, and one would think that the government would put that forth to support its version. But until that happens, it's not at all clear what exactly happened.
Well, Maduro himself on an international address said, "A flying object exploded near me, a big explosion. Seconds later, there was a second explosion." So the group that you mentioned is, I believe it's called Soldiers in T-Shirts. They're the people who took credit for this attack. What do you know about them?
Well, this is a group that is consists of people that are allied with Oscar Perez, who was the dissident police officer who a year ago stole a helicopter and threw some shot grenades out at a ministry and was sort of on the run for about 10 months. You know, that would actually fit because they tend to do sort of attacks that are sort of like anarchist type attacks, that they're not terribly well planned out and they're not very realistic, but they make a lot of they make a big splash. So it certainly consists with the type of attacks that they have carried out before.
Well, I thought he was maybe a military officer, but you say he's a policeman who carried out that 2017 helicopter attack. He, of course, was later surrounded by government forces, Oscar Perez, and he was killed, right? I mean, they really did not want to capture him alive.
Yeah, that's right. He was killed, and the evidence suggests that he was probably assassinated, he and the rest of them. He was trying to negotiate and turn himself in. And apparently, when they went in, they just killed everybody that was there. And so, yeah, because they definitely didn't want him alive and in jail because he was sort of a hero for some sectors of the population. And, you know, this is a dissident group that opposes the government, thinks that the government is no longer democratic and that they have to sort of reestablish order through these means. There was also a communique published by officers of the military. It's not exactly clear if these are the same people from the Soldiers in T-Shirts group that also said that they were trying to reestablish democratic order by overthrowing Maduro.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smaldi, who is in Bogota, Colombia. He is the Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Relations at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for almost 30 years and has written or edited three books on it. And he curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. And he's testified to the United States Senate Foreign Relations Committee and has written opinion articles for The Washington Post and The New York Times. So, ironically, of course, President Maduro, speaking at the 81st anniversary of the National Army to a military audience when these drones or whatever they were exploded, I believe he was talking about the economy. And boy, you'd have a hard time justifying that total ruination of the Venezuelan economy by Maduro, who of course is determined to hold on to power, but continues to ruin the country. So, what exactly was he saying? Do we know?
Well, at the time, you know, he was saying just very, very broad generalizations that he was going to reform the economy and that he needed people on his side and support him. it was not a concrete message at all. I mean, he's been saying this for, you know, for the past week or so, that August 20, there's going to be a new currency rolled out and there's going to be economic reforms. They've also talked about liberating the currency. And, you know, and that is sort of the real base, the most basic problem with Venezuela, is that they have this huge, enormous control, exchange control distortions that lead these huge opportunities for corruption. So the resources that they have end up not going to actual imports or going to what people need. They end up going into the pockets of people that have scams to take advantage of the exchange control. So they say they're going to reform it. That's what needs to be done. But they've said this many times over the past few years, and they never quite managed to do it.
So you're in Colombia now. I wonder what the Colombian president makes of these charges by Maduro that came quickly after this reported assassination attempt, where he blamed the president of Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, for the assassination, of course, and then also blamed the United States. And obviously, President Trump does not help because he has threatened to send the U.S. military down to invade Venezuela, the very thing that plays right into Maduro's hands. But since he's been crying wolf so often, blaming the U.S. for everything, and now he's blaming Colombia, is it working? And, of course, he did not offer any evidence.
No, it's not working. I think, you know, Juan Manuel Santos actually turns over the presidency on Tuesday. So this is the very end of his administration. And I don't think he's going to pay too much attention to this. They quickly put out a press release denying that Colombia had anything to do with this. It was a very short press release. And, of course, the Venezuelan government provided no evidence of this, that Colombia or the United States was involved. And so I don't think there'd be too much attention paid to it. Of course, this works for that 20% of the population that still follow Maduro and believe his conspiracy theories that fit within a sort of anti-imperialist model of what the international relations are. So there's always this idea that the United States is sort of pulling the strings and has its satellite countries like Colombia that are trying to undermine any sort of national liberation movement like Chavismo in Venezuela. So that is always the framework, and they're not going to provide any evidence for that. I think it's highly unlikely that a very sort of amateurish attack like this would have any sort of international backing to it. I think that this is dissident fringe military sectors that are acting. I think this, you know, does not indicate really broad discontent within the military or a really big danger. However, I think the optics of this attack, I think, were really, really bad. I think that this attack itself actually could go some ways to sort of giving people a sense that he's not as invulnerable as it looks. So, I mean, a non-debt democratic leader like Maduro always has the task of trying to portray himself as invincible, as inevitable. And having this attack, having him interrupted in mid-speech, and having his soldiers, not just soldiers, the National Guard and the Guardia de Honor, the Honor Guard, who protects the president, having them scatter and run for cover, you know, the optics were just absolutely terrible for Maduro, and I think they must be quite worried about this.
So enormous numbers of Venezuelans have fled, have they not, as economic refugees to both Colombia and Brazil. And that's creating tremendous problems for Colombia, where you are now, David Smaldi. It is clearly a kind of tyranny of the minority in Venezuela, where this government that just sort of arranged a kind of bogus referendum and got themselves reelected just sort of holds on to power without offering any solutions for the very problems that they create. And how much are the Cubans running the show? That's my understanding, is that one of the reasons why there hasn't been a military coup against Maduro, who clearly has ruined the country, is because the Cubans have got their security people at all levels of the infrastructure in both intelligence and military.
I think without a doubt, the Cubans are involved in the security apparatus. They're Maduro's most important advisors. And I think that indeed has a big impact on the fact that there's been that they've persisted as long as possible. I mean, they have very good information, and what looked like it was another coup attempt in the works in May was disbanded because of this intelligence. So the Cubans are very important to Maduro. They're not in charge. No, Maduro's in charge, and the Maduro government is in charge. But Cuban intelligence, Cuban security officials are very important for Maduro.
Well, just in the last minute, is this agony just going to go on? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think right now Maduro is actually in quite a strong position, which is another reason why this does not look like it was staged by the government itself. He's in a quite strong position. He just got through the fourth Socialist Party Congress. He was reelected. He's quite strong within his government and within his party. He doesn't have big challengers. Furthermore, the political opposition is completely disorganized and infighting as usual. So in the country, he's quite strong. However, he's presiding over a governance disaster and has hyperinflation that could reach 1,000,000% this year. There are people that are going hungry. There's mass exodus, mass migration leaving Venezuela, which is really complicating the government itself. And furthermore, internationally, the main countries in the hemisphere as well as the European Union don't recognize Maduro's reelection. Furthermore, there's a sort of a net of sanctions that have been cast around Venezuela that are complicating Venezuela's finances, Venezuela's ability to do business. So these things mean that it's quite complicated for Maduro. Even if he's strong within his party and his government, he's he's very vulnerable from the outside and from the inside because of the economy.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest. Yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who is a Charles A. and Leo M. Favreau Professor of Human Rights at Tulane University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. He has studied Venezuela for almost 30 years and has written and edited 3 books on it and curates a blog called Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. And he's testified before the United States Senate's Foreign Relations Committee. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll get an assessment of if and when journalists will be either assaulted, injured, or killed because of President Trump's incendiary, hateful rhetoric against the press. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Peter Stern, a senior reporter at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He runs the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, a website that aims to comprehensively track all press freedom incidents, including arrests of journalists, equipment seizures, border stops, and subpoenas of news organizations in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Stern.
Thank you for having me.
And Peter, from your position, I imagine you have to be disturbed by the withering attacks on the press from President Trump. And they've been going on for some time. Back on July the 20th, he met with the publisher of the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger, Sulzberger pressed Trump on the what he said was deeply troubling anti-press rhetoric, saying that this inflammatory language is contributing to the rise of threats against journalists and will lead to violence. Of course, Trump completely mischaracterized that meeting by tweeting out that he had a good meeting where they discussed the vast amounts of fake news being put out by the media. Sulzberger then had to go public with what really was said. And then, of course, last Tuesday, there was a rally in Florida where Trump attacked the press, and then he escalated his attacks on Thursday of last week at a rally in Pennsylvania, where he really, if you look at the pictures, he turns to the press, and he really is deeply angry and full of spite and hate. He just says these are disgusting people. So it couldn't be more obvious and more blatant and I think more dangerous. Jim Acosta was screamed at. So from my point of view, I think it's just a matter of time before a journalist is either assaulted, injured, or something worse.
Yeah, I mean, what was really striking about that meeting that he had with Sulzberger is that Trump later said that, you know, he was talking with Sulzberger and he was talking about how great it was that all these other countries are now cracking down on fake news. And obviously, what a lot of other countries are doing is they're now outlawing fake news, but just like Trump, they're not actually concerned about the accuracy of the news. They are just cracking down on news and on media that is critical of them. So you see this in Turkey, you see this in Egypt, you see this in Malaysia. And what's very concerning is that now we have a president who sees any news coverage of him that is not favorable as being fake and as being not only untrue, but potentially damaging to the country. You know, he says that journalists are the enemy of the American people. He says that journalists are trying to sell out the country, that they don't have the United States' best interests at heart. And I think that is very concerning rhetoric. Obviously, there's always been an adversarial relationship between journalists who cover the president of the United States and the president. You know, naturally, journalists try to report things that people in power don't want found out. And presidents have always reacted negatively toward that. But I think what you see with Trump is something worse, where he is actually telling his supporters, and a lot of people believe him, that journalists are not just reporting things that he doesn't like or even that are exaggerated, but he's saying that journalists are making up sources and they're fabricating news stories with the aim of bringing him down and ending his presidency and hurting his supporters. So he's really trying to portray journalists not just as people who occasionally get things wrong or even sensationalist, but as active agents of evil who are trying to undermine the United States. And that's very concerning because I think that that's the kind of language that leads people to take physical action against members of the press. You know, if you're a Trump supporter and you believe that journalists are not just doing their jobs and trying to inform people, but are instead making things up because they don't like you and they want you to lose, then you are not going to have any respect for them. And in fact, you're probably going to see them as someone who is potentially dangerous to you and someone you might need to fight back against physically. So I think that is really the concern that we see. And, you know, you might think that the United States is a relatively safe place for journalists, and that's certainly true compared to a lot of countries. You know, it's not as bad as Mexico, where you have dozens of journalists being murdered each year. But journalists in the United States do get physically assaulted. It's usually when they're going and covering protests where people can sometimes get violent and shove journalists or try to steal their cameras or notebooks, or sometimes, you know, they get caught in pepper spray and tear gas when the police are trying to disperse protests, or police arrest them or shoot, you know, rubber bullets at them. And of course, in addition to that, there are also relatively rare, but a few incidents in which people attack journalists because they are unhappy specifically with their coverage. Like, that's what happened in Annapolis, Maryland, where you had the mass shooting of journalists by someone who was unhappy that the newspaper had reported on him. And we haven't seen any serious attacks on journalists yet as a direct result of Trump's rhetoric. But I think that the danger of Trump's rhetoric is that he's getting people to believe that the media can't be trusted, that the media is against them. And that makes it much easier for his supporters to justify violence against the media. Whereas before, they might have just dismissed it or said, oh, I don't believe that, whatever. Now they see journalists as enemies of the United States and as enemies of American values, and potentially would resort to violence against them.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Stern, who's a senior reporter at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He runs the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, a website that aims to comprehensively track all press freedom incidents, including arrests of journalists, equipment seizures, border stops, and subpoenas of news organizations in the United States. And in my sort of opening litany of Trump's attacks on the press, I forgot to mention that at a veterans convention on July the 24th, Trump referred to the press as being very unpatriotic and turned to the veterans who are normally supposed to be apolitical, saying, don't believe the crap you see from these people, the fake news, pointing at the reporters again. What you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening. And then just to finish up on what you just said, Peter, the conservative columnist in the New York Times, Brett Stevens, had a piece, I think, yesterday or Saturday, where he said at the end of the article, there will soon be blood on the floor of a newsroom, and that will be blood on the president's hands. So the warnings are out there, but there doesn't seem any indication that President Trump's going to slow down or ease up on his withering attacks on the press. If anything, they will increase as we head into a more intense political season. That, at least, is my assumption.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct. I mean, obviously, Sulzberger, after meeting with Trump, did say that, you know, Trump seemed to get it, or at least say that, I feel bad that my rhetoric is potentially justifying violence and attacks on the press in other countries. And I think that, you know, he would also say that he doesn't want journalists in the United States to be killed. But I think that he just doesn't care, especially when he's at a rally or he's on Twitter. He's primarily motivated by kind of a personal animus towards journalists who report things that he doesn't like. He will just call them fake news and say that they're disloyal, not necessarily because he believes that they are actually enemies of the American people who, you know, you can use violence against, but just because he gets so angry when he reads reporting that is negative toward him that he just... That's sort of his automatic response, is to delegitimize the press and to say that they can't be trusted. And he doesn't care if that inflames people and potentially leads to violence against the press. I don't think he necessarily wants journalists to be killed, but I don't think he cares enough about it to not try to attack them on Twitter.
So what can the press do, particularly the White House press corps? Because Jim Acosta, who was attacked and hissed and screamed and spat at the rally last Tuesday in Florida, where there were a lot of these people from this new far-right group that's emerged called QAnon, and they were all over that rally, and they're right out there on the fringes of right-wing lunacy. So they're quite inherently dangerous people. Acosta asked Sarah Sanders, the White House press spokesperson, about Ivanka Trump's comments that the press, she, in her opinion, the press are not the enemy of the people. And she was refused to agree with that. And so 4 times in 2 days, in fact, Sanders refused to say that the media is not the enemy of the people. So
would it make sense for the White House press corps to simply boycott the White House? I know that Fox and Sinclair would not do that, but at what point does the press basically say enough already?
I mean, I don't think it would necessarily be helpful to, you know, refuse to cover Trump. On the one hand, he does obviously appreciate media coverage, but, you know, he also is still the president and has a lot of power. And I don't think it would be better if he did things and no one knew about them. So I think there is a reason to continue going to, you know, White House press briefings and to still cover Trump. I mean, maybe don't cover his rallies live. I'm not sure that really informs the American people. But in general, I think it's important to cover the White House and the presidency. I would say don't let him go off the record. You know, I don't think the press owes him that level of respect to allow him to, you know, go off the record and say what he's really thinking, but then they can't print it. That is an understandable arrangement, maybe, when you have a president who respects the press and who actually cares about what they're trying to do. But with Trump, it's so clear that he disdains the press and that he doesn't care about their reporting and will just seek to discredit it, even if it's true. I see no reason to allow him to say anything off the record. I think that the press should continue to be aggressive in covering what he does. I don't know if that will prevent people from attacking them. I think that there's a section of the country that will just attack the press no matter what. But I do think that there's no reason to accord Trump any respect just because he's the president if he's going to go around and suggest that journalists are enemies of the American people.
Well, I think the latest tally now on Trump's lies since he became president by the Washington Post, it's up to over 4,200. And you have to add to a couple of howlers that came out of Saturday's rally in Ohio, where the president said that Dianne Feinstein was actually running the Mueller investigation, not Mueller. And then he attacked Dianne Feinstein and ridiculed her for having a Chinese spy as a driver, when in fact the true story is that the FBI did inform Senator Feinstein that they thought her driver, who had no access to classified material or even sensitive material, the minute that she found out, Senator Feinstein fired the driver. So again, this is what happens on a daily basis. So is there any way for, again, without sort of abandoning their jobs, can they basically demand some basic honesty instead of being essentially insulted by a blizzard of lies?
I mean, I think they can certainly demand honesty. I don't think they're going to get it from Trump. I don't know if other people in the White House, like you know, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, will give it to them. I would hope so, but I definitely don't think they're going to get it from Trump. And I think that they need to treat Trump as kind of a hostile subject, which is to say that whenever they quote him, whenever they refer to something that he says, they need to immediately contextualize it with the truth. You know, in past administrations, it's generally been seen as acceptable to just attribute something to the president or the White House. And if there's no evidence that it's false, you know, you don't really need to independently fact check it, because generally speaking, the federal government and the White House was seen as a reliable, trustworthy source. And obviously there are instances in which the press deferred too much to the White House. You know, you look at what happened in 2003 with the lead-up to the Iraq War. But in general, I think the press has deferred to what the White House says. And I think it's very clear now that that cannot continue. Anytime you quote Trump, anytime you mention what he says in the headline of an article, you need to say if he's lying and say what the truth is. Like, obviously, you need to report on what Trump says and thinks because he has a lot of power. But you want to make sure that, at least for your readers, the people who still trust what journalists report, still trust that they are trying to report the truth, that you are not helping to spread the president's lies. So when you quote Trump, you also say, this is the truth. This is what Trump says. And I think Trump would see that as an attack on him, but it's not an attack on him if you're just reporting the truth. Something is not fake news just because the president disagrees with it.
So what do you make of this strange attack on this very, very popular basketball player, LeBron James? And it happened, Trump attacked and actually ridiculed both the CNN interviewer, Don Lemon, and LeBron James in, I think, unmistakably racist terms, basically saying they were dumb and not very bright. And he said the same thing of Maxine Waters, the Democratic congresswoman out here in California. And that's unquestionably an old racist canard that he's reviving. But then his wife comes out and says the opposite, in effect, and wanted to visit the school that LeBron James is funding and has created. And he's obviously doing some really good work. In fact, Don Lemon tweeted back saying, who is the dummy? The man who educates children or the one who puts children in cages? So is that, do you think there's a good cop, bad cop routine going on there? And to some extent, it may be going on with Ivanka as well. Or do you think there is genuine differences there where the wife was apparently appalled by what he said, and that also Ivanka, as I mentioned earlier, made it clear that she didn't believe that the press were the enemy of the people?
I mean, it's not clear, obviously, what their motivations are, whether they genuinely believe, you know, that the press are not the enemy of the American people, or you know, whether they respect what LeBron is doing. I imagine that Melania and Ivanka probably do believe what they said, just because it's not really controversial to say that it's good that someone is creating a new public school, or that journalists are not the enemy of the American people. That's sort of the obvious position. So I don't know whether they are sort of trying to compensate for what Trump said, or if they're just trying to, you know, express that they have a different opinion. But I also don't really think it matters. I mean, Trump is the president, and if they, especially in the case of Ivanka, you know, if she truly believes that the press are not the enemy of the American people, then she should intervene and get her father to stop saying that. And if she doesn't do that, then it doesn't really matter whether or not she believes it, if she's not going to do anything about it. You know, Trump attacks anyone who criticizes him. I think he especially is upset or offended when people he sees as lesser than him criticize him. And I think that he takes particular offense when, you know, African Americans criticize him because he is racist, or at least he has those racist beliefs and interpretations. So I'm not surprised that he would attack, LeBron or Don Lemon or Maxine Waters. You know, he also attacks a lot of Latino journalists and activists, and he attacks white journalists as well, just not in such stark terms. Trump just, you know, he has a group of people that he dislikes because they don't like him and because his policies hurt them. And any time that they criticize him, he just immediately fights back. I mean, it's clear to me that Trump isn't committed to values like equality or freedom of speech and press. Not that he necessarily wants to get rid of those things, but he just doesn't care. For him, the concern seems to be whether or not people are talking favorably about him. And if they're not, then he's going to go after them and seek to delegitimize them and suggest that they are lying or that they're dumb.
Well, Peter Stern, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Stern, who's a senior reporter at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He runs the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, a website that aims to comprehensively track all press freedom incidents, including arrests of journalists, equipment seizures, border stops, and subpoenas of news organizations in the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Jared Kushner was just rewarded with a cash infusion from the Qataris for 666 Fifth Avenue, a building he ever paid for when he was courting Ivanka. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Cohen, a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And his latest book is The Last Tycoons, A Secret History of Lazard Frere & Company. And he is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times. And his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohen.
Thank you for having me, Ian, as always.
Well, thank you. Bill, I've been trying to follow this 666 Fifth Avenue story for some time. Obviously, back in 2007, Jared Kushner, who wanted to impress Ivanka Trump, he bought a newspaper and he bought the most expensive piece of real estate in New York, trying to sort of establish a foothold as a Manhattan real estate tycoon, I guess to impress his future father-in-law, since basically the Kushner's business was in New Jersey. So he bought this 666 Fifth Avenue for $1.8 billion in 2007. Then shortly thereafter, you had the Wall Street crash, and it's basically been underwater ever since. And there's a $1.4 billion mortgage due in February of next year. And then suddenly they get rescued. It turns out that this company, Brookfield, it's largely owned by the Qataris, they have put up paid up front $1.1 billion in upfront rent on a 99-year lease. So let's start with that. That's pretty unusual, isn't it, to pay everything in front? What do they get for that $1.1 billion?
Well, I think what's really going on is they've bought the building for $1.1 billion, just like, say, I bought my co-op apartment in New York and got a 99-year lease to live in it. So basically, they bought this building for $1.1 billion. The Kushners were able to make that deal in part because they had reached another deal with Steve Roth at Vornado to buy his 49% stake in the building for something like $125 million. So then they were able to convey the full ownership of the building to Brookfield. And I guess as part of this as well, it's not completely clear. They've renegotiated the mortgage so that that $1.4 billion that was due is now refinanced out. and pushed out. And so essentially, you know, if one reads between the lines of all of this, the Kushners are out. They were literally rescued from what surely would have been a loss of their equity investment, clearly a default on the mortgage of $1.4 billion that they wouldn't have been able to pay because the building is worth considerably less than that. And for whatever reason, the Qataris, through Brookfield, which is a publicly traded company based in Canada that owns all sorts of other buildings in Manhattan, you know, is now going to own this building for 99 years, and which is generally longer than most people's lifetimes, and are going to try to reposition it in the marketplace and make a go of it.
But do you think this would be happening at all if Jared Kushner were not a special assistant to the President of the United States? I mean, from his position in the White House, he's already tried to get the Chinese to bail him out from yeah. this building. Then he went to the Qataris. He went to Hamid Jassim bin Al Thani, the one of the country's former prime minister and a member of the ruling family. Of course, prior to that, he went to Anbang, the giant Chinese insurance company. There's a great deal of reporting. BBC's Paul Wood and others have pointed out that there's a real possibility that Jared Kushner used his position as a Middle East envoy of the White House in conjunction with MBZ in the Emirates and MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, to basically lean on the Qataris and say, you know, give us, I believe he asked for $500 million, they refused. And then shortly thereafter, the Saudis and the Emiratis began a blockade. So it's not that difficult to put two and two together. Apparently, both General Mattis and Secretary of State at the time, Tillerson, were blindsided by this, and the White House didn't even realize that the biggest American base in the Middle East or in the Gulf is in Qatar. So let me just go back to the initial question. I know it's been a long one. Would any of this be happening if this guy didn't have the kind of clout of being in the White House?
So, of course, that's, you know, virtually impossible to know unless one were to have a conversation with Jared, which is clearly not forthcoming. I think that they are likely to be quite closely linked, however. It's kind of a twofer for Brookfield in the sense that by doing this, they have curried favor in a big way with the White House and with parts of the White House that aren't going anywhere. I mean, Jared is, even if Jared and Ivanka return to New York, is something they will by the end of the year. Donald Trump is still Jared's father-in-law, and Ivanka is still, Donald Trump is still Ivanka's father. So there's no question that part of the calculus here was to try to impress win access to curry favor with the Trump administration for as long as it lasts. But I think, we're talking about a fair amount of money here, too. So, you know, more than $1 billion. Publicly traded companies do not, invest that $1 billion, at least in this country, if they don't also believe there's a decent business deal attached to it. Look, you know, 66 Fifth Avenue is, you know, primo location on Fifth Avenue at around 52nd and 53rd Streets. It's definitely a bit of a dowager. It's old. It hasn't been updated, modernized, which many of the office buildings in Midtown Manhattan have been modernized. So there, it's also has a lot of tenancy unoccupied. It's got a lobby that's kind of tired. It is also, I believe, Ian, a real seriously good business opportunity for Brookfield Asset Management to redevelop this business, to redo the lobby, to put in new elevators, to tenant up the building, to get new retail tenants in the ground floor areas. All of that, I think, presents Brookfield with a business opportunity that they believe they can make money on, or else they wouldn't have done it. So that's why I say I think it's a twofer. I think they probably, with a little skill, they are skilled. You know, they've revitalized the old World Financial Center after down, you know, which is where Merrill Lynch and Dow Jones used to be, right next to the World Trade Center after 9/11. They bought that property, have completely revitalized that whole area and that whole project to their credit. So I do think they know what they're doing with real estate in Manhattan, and I suspect they believe they can make a real go of it. At the same time, they are also have successfully bailed out the Kushner family of by far its largest and most disastrous real estate project, where they tried to become bigwigs by crossing the river from New Jersey into Manhattan. And this will definitely give them another lease on life. They're doing projects in Brooklyn. They're trying to buy a cooperative apartment on Park Avenue and redevelop that into an office building. So these people are on the move. They are by no means out of business, and this absolutely saved them. And I'm sure they'll have a long memory about this. They seem to have a long memory about everything, those Kushners.
And again, I'm speaking with William Cohen. He's a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere & Company, Merrill Lynch, and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He's a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes a biweekly opinion column in the New York Times, and his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. So, the father, of course, when you mentioned the Kushners, I guess you can't be more hard-nosed than what the father did with his own brother-in-law, who was married to his sister. Apparently there was some family squabble over some investments or other or trust.
Yeah,
I don't
putting
know.
Putting it politely, yes.
Yeah, and what Charles Kushner did was he hired a hooker and set up the brother-in-law in a sting, and then tried to blackmail his own sister with a video of her husband cavorting with a hooker that Charles Kushner had hired. Of course, to the credit of Kushner's sister, she told the brother to go to hell, and he ended up in jail. And by the way, he was put in jail by Governor Chris Christie, who was then the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. So that's not exactly a I mean,
no. These are hard-nosed business people. They are like Trump himself. I think they are equally as ruthless. I think that's why this is sort of a good match for the family. Obviously, Ivanka thought so too. She is willing to convert to Orthodox Judaism to marry Jared. These are deal doers. They are ruthless. They will, stop at nothing, and not unlike Donald Trump himself. So I see it all as a piece, frankly, and that's why I also believe there's little doubt that this is a very sophisticated and on one hand, and also not so sophisticated effort to curry favor with the White House, which, frankly, in this environment where every company or corporate CEO or world famous basketball player or CNN host is one tweet away from the president's barbs on Twitter, is probably a good position to be in rather than being on the other side of him.
Well, we'll just
it's a shame it's come to this, but
sure.
That's where we are.
Well, we just have to watch and see whether the Qataris are rewarded by having the embargo lifted. Then I think you could connect the dots
pretty easily.
But do you think that Jared is in fact the kind of inheritor here? It seems like
Reports indicate that, one, Donald Trump is very nervous and very agitated that his son, Donald Trump Jr., may be indicted by Special Counsel Mueller, but that he has the Trump sort of, you know, his namesake, his Donald Jr., he considers a bit of a, you know, a loser, I guess, to use Trump's word. And whereas Jared may well be the inheritor of the empire, along with his wife. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, certainly he's the heir apparent to the Kushner companies. You know, his brother Josh has is a venture capitalist, and is sort of distancing himself from the family's political aspirations and interests. He's, of course, just agreed to marry his supermodel girlfriend. So I don't see Josh being the heir apparent of the Kushner company. I see clearly Jared being the heir apparent. I mean, I think the idea is if they were to, you know, return to New York at the end of the year, and, you know, whether they do that or not, also always seems to fluctuate, you know, depending on who's up and who's down in the administration. But, you know, he would clearly is going to take over the real estate business from his father when he gets done in the White House. Whether or not that ends up resulting in a, you know, some sort of global merger with the Trump organization, now that would certainly be something, and something I hadn't contemplated before. But you know, I see him a very much a cut above than Donald's two sons, one of whom you say, as you say, Don Jr., who I've heard, you know, Mueller has already issued unsealed sealed indictments for him. I don't know whether that's true or not. You know, Eric is frankly not up to the task, as has been portrayed repeatedly on Saturday Night Live. So, I mean, I could possibly see a merger between the Trump organization and the Kushner organization at some point down the road, with Jared leading the whole charge. I don't feel like that whole family is going to be spending a whole lot much more time in Washington. You know, whether it's a few years or less, you know, I think it seems to me their time is coming to the end. But you know, I could be wrong. Many of us were very wrong about his election in the first place. But I think that people are coming to the realization that things have gotten a little bit out of hand at this point. So, if and when he returns to New York, I could absolutely see him returning to his family business, and then one day having a merger of the families as well as the family businesses.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me in.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, as a former senior Wall Street investment banker for 17 years at Lazard Frere and Company, Merrill Lynch and J.P. Morgan Chase, as well as a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, and House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He is a special correspondent at Vanity Fair and writes the biweekly opinion column in the New York Times. And his latest book is Why Wall Street Matters. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.